What is going on, world of Let the Movie Speak listeners? We are going back in time to the present, to now, coming in your ear waves. And I am Justin, as I usually am, joined by a couple other people here. Please, other people, introduce yourself.
I, as usual, as well, am Travis. And we have a returning, probably the most guested person.
The most senior guest.
Well, let's not use that one.
That might be true, too, actually.
That connotates elite status.
And wisdom.
Not just the fact that I'm old. Yeah. Okay. I'm Annie.
Yes.
And I'm back.
With a movie that is just exactly like the other ones you've chosen so far. It's, what did you do? You did...
Thin Man.
The Thin Man.
And then The Bogey and Bacall that Justin loved.
Big Sleep.
Oh, yes.
And then we did Adam's Rib.
And then...
I laughed at you a lot, which was delightful.
Shut up. And then today we have something just almost exactly like all of those.
Yeah.
12 Monkeys.
Yeah.
From 1995.
Yeah, that's usually referred to as the trilogy.
Wait.
The quadrilogy? The
quadrilogy.
Well, excuse me, guys. The Big Sleep is not really a movie. It's just the other three.
That's fair. Yeah. Everybody says The Big Sleep doesn't belong in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it doesn't belong, period. It's not just in the trilogy. It's just within existence.
Yeah.
People go, what a colossal mistake. Why did we do that?
That is what most people
said. Which I think we all agreed about on that episode.
Unanimously, yeah.
We agreed that you thought that, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to talk about 1995's 12 Monkeys, which is our fourth. It's the fourth, but we'll drop one of those so that there's not a quadrilogy. There's a trilogy. It's a fourth time travel movie. We've worked
on quadrilogy. Yes. Is that a word?
Sure. Well,
Travis and I have been using it for the last couple minutes.
That's great. Yeah. I really like that, guys.
Thank you.
Good job.
It doesn't really apply because we're going to do two more, but The Time Machine, Somewhere in Time, Groundhog Day, and then today we land in the 90s again, really. But I would say that this movie feels, eons away from Groundhog Day, Justin, as a movie?
Yeah, eon is not a large enough distance. It's at least 12 parsecs away, Travis.
So many parsecs. So before we get into 12 Monkeys, we're going to do our normal stuff at the beginning here. But before we even get into our normal stuff, as in what did we watch this week, we have a little...
A PSA.
A PSA, a news bulletin item.
Very important. Listen up.
Yeah, you need to know this. We've been super happy and excited that many of you who have listened have gone through the trouble to go on Apple Podcasts and do the little stars thing. Give us a rating. Because if you didn't know, the way podcasts work is you get more ratings, you get moved up, and more people can see that you exist. So we were super honored this last week, if I'm not mistaken, Justin, to receive a special gift there.
Oh, my goodness. Gift of gifts. The wise men had not brought such... wares as we received in the form of our first one-star review.
That's right.
Now, in case you're not familiar with how podcast ratings work, one is not like the best.
One is bad.
One is this is not golf. one is bad.
It's very bad.
And so we want to say to that individual, whether you be man, woman, or porpoise, or something in between, we thank you. For your honesty, integrity. Thank you for standing up to the system.
Thank you.
I just want to say there is way too much...
capitulating.
Bad,
yes.
I mean, I'm just talking about like corporate oversight, greed.
Of course.
Ugh. Amazon. Oh, my gosh. So thank you. Thank you for coming to the workers' aid and, and leaving us some real wisdom.
Yeah, and thank you so much, by the way, for leaving words along with it, because it's super helpful when you get some feedback on something, when someone says 1 out of 5 stars, no notes. That's really, that's excellent.
Not even a period, as in this is final.
Yeah.
Just a whole lot of nothing. So we would encourage those of you who despise us at our very cores, who look at us and wish that you could, euthanize us. We pray and beseech you, we plead with you, leave us your most honest criticism. We would be happy to read it aloud once we're done weeping, and we look forward to those comments. So good or bad, please, please send us your comments.
Please. Yeah, we would I would like to take this opportunity to once again thank our one-star reviewer. You're great. Thank you for going through the trouble to do that.
Thank you so much.
But more than that, if you're listening to this show and you think we're worth more than one star, if you could just give us like 5, that would be great because that would
help. I'll take two,
but I would prefer 5. Two might sink the algorithm even more, but that's okay. We don't need no algorithm. We're going to be fine.
We do not.
Yeah. Mm-mm.
Self-sufficient here.
Yeah. We're going to be good.
They can't stop us.
No.
Okay.
You can't make a podcast end. You just can't.
Nope.
And we're going to be here until we're 48 years old.
Yeah. Well, we're 47
Wait,
right
what
now,
are you so. Saying I'm about sa- being 48?
No, I'm saying we're 47.
That's great.
And we have another year. Yeah. Anyway,
I'm not there yet.
That was stupid. Let's talk about what we watched this week. Justin, I'm going to ask myself this week first, because every time I send it to you first, you have a little qualm with that. So
A remark.
So anyway, this week I rewatched a movie that I'd seen a few times that I saw in theaters, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. Martin Scorsese, Leonardo DiCaprio, who's the Michelle Williams? She's the one from Gatsby, right? Mm-hmm. And a million
That's
other
a
things.
Person. Mm-hmm.
That's a person. Shutter Island, which is a Dennis Lehane.
Brand new film.
It's brand new. No, it's from like 2010, probably. And it's a Dennis Lehane novel. Who I think he also wrote Mystic River, and that was a good movie too.
Mm-hmm.
I like Shutter Island. If you're into the like over the top Hitchcock homage stuff by Scorsese, it's I think it can be good fun. It's certainly not anybody's like I don't think it's his magnum opus or anything, but I think it's a good adaptation of like the tone of the book makes sense. It with what he did with the movie. If you don't care about the twist, you probably don't care about the movie, kind of a movie. And mm-hmm. It works on me because I hate trying to guess things. Like I'm not one of those people who sits and I'm like, you know, ooh, if he said that, then it must mean this, or ooh, I mean, maybe he, you know, is this, you know, I'm not that kind of person. So
what are you saying about that kind of person?
I'm not saying anything.
Please tell us more.
I am that type of person.
That's totally fair. It decreases my ability to enjoy the movie
fair
if
enough.
I'm spending brain power trying to figure out the plot. So I would say if you like mysteries and it's spooky, like suspense thriller, psychological thriller, and it's Scorsese, so it's super well directed and totally worth your time, in my opinion. Annie, what'd you watch this week?
Well, let me go back about 18 months.
Okay.
I don't know if any of you have noticed that the last 18 months have been a little rough.
They've been great.
Okay. Well, my last 18 months have been a little rough, unlike the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And so it's comfort viewing has been important, as it has for many. And so when I need comfort viewing, I go to the Brits.
Yeah.
I just find them
warm and inviting.
Well, comforting. And so there's two ways in which I think the British just do general entertainment well in the way Americans often don't. One is in their like game shows, because they invite comics and like professional communicators and funny people mm-hmm. to be in, you know, to be fighting for the, you know, to win the thing. And it just makes the show so much more entertaining than, you know, some of our American ones where it's just like person off the street who has no charisma or ability to speak in front of people.
I wish every game show was that.
And so I guess for recommendations, if you guys or anyone out there is looking for some kind of entertaining but not totally mindless TV to watch, there's a game show called QI, which stands for Quite Interesting, and another one called Would I Lie to You? And those are both like family-friendly, easy to watch shows.
Yeah.
Some of them do get sweary. So, you know, beware your audience. And then also they're just I love their dramas because they cast, for the most part, they cast people who look like people.
Yeah.
And I just find that really...
Not an American thing,
no,
is it?
No, no. Like, not every detective is 26 years old.
With steely blue eyes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So I would just say, if anyone out there hasn't kind of researched the British version of your favorite American entertainment... Yeah. Go do it.
Give it a whirl.
Go do it.
What's that IT show that you really...
Oh, the IT Crowd.
Yeah. I've heard good things from...
That's
from
a good one.
Please go watch the IT Crowd.
Yeah. Justin likes it too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Nice. It's a great show.
It's really good. So anyway, there's lots of... Oh, there's a show called Taskmaster, which is a bunch of comedians having to complete totally ridiculous challenges. Like, one of them is, how much watermelon can you eat in a minute? And another one is, paint a horse while riding on a horse.
I like that.
Totally, total nonsense. The first two seasons on YouTube are bleeped. So those are mostly family friendly. There's a couple words I wish they had bleeped before I watched it with my 8-year-old niece. but the rest of the seasons aren't, and so they may be more for older audiences. But
so you're saying
they're good
nonsense, but they do nonsense better.
They do nonsense. Yeah.
That's some. There's something to be said for that.
They don't rot your brain.
Okay.
They just entertain it.
Okay. Fair enough. Mm-hmm. Check out the Brits, is what Annie says.
Yes.
Justin, what'd you watch this week?
Well, to go off of that, before I forget, Annie, have you ever seen that moment in history known as It's a Royal Knockout?
No.
Which was a... I quite agree with you that of the little British game show stuff that I've seen, it is, superior is maybe too mild a term compared to what we suffer with here in the unappreciative colonies. But the Royal Knockout was this thing that Prince Edward organized to be a part of in the late 80s. And so it was a charity event. It's based off of a show that was already on, I think, in the UK called It's a Knockout. And so having very similar goofy games to what you described.
Mm-hmm.
But the benefit of this one-off is that Princess, which one was it? Princess
Anne,
is playing against Prince Edward's team. And so just to have these people that have this reputation of being this very stodgy and, you know, arcane class, and symbol of the UK, just doing ridiculous antics. It's frankly one of the funniest and most enjoyable things I've ever seen.
Well, I'm going to have to look that up.
So I think for anyone that's interested, I think it is on YouTube. My wife is quite the British royal family. I don't know, what is the proper term?
She's nerd.
Yeah, that'll work, I think.
Well, she and I will have to have a conversation because...
Oh, excellent. You would have much to talk about.
Yeah, I know way more than I wish I knew, and yet I keep learning more.
I don't know. It seems to be the way it goes. I think nerddom, that must be a part of nerddom that is unexplored. So let me commend that to everybody. And the movie that I watched this week was No Sudden Move, which is out on old HBO Max, one of approximately 4,731 streaming services that are currently available.
That's it.
And it's a Soderbergh movie. We've talked about old Steve before. This is the Ocean's Guy, and this is another ensemble cast kind of movie for sure. Don Cheadle's in here, John Hamm, Benicio del Toro. Great cast, and it takes place in 50s Detroit, and is it's like an Ocean's movie in terms of it does know how to have fun, but unlike the Ocean's movies, you do feel like there are some real stakes here. Nobody is going to be doing any acrobatics over laser beams in this movie, there's some really good Soderbergh kind of interactions between characters. A lot of people are likable, even if you feel like maybe this person shouldn't be so likable. Travis, our good friend Ray Liotta, is even in there for a while.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw just a little flash of him in the trailer, and I was like, I'm in. Yep.
Yeah, it's really good, and it has something to... in keeping with what we do here on this show or try to do, this movie does have something to say.
Yeah.
So I think that is kind of what separates it from Ocean's movies. I don't want to give anything away because my good friend and co-host here has not seen it yet, guys. I'm just letting you know.
Thank you.
We were supposed to, let me whisper this so he doesn't hear, but we were supposed to do this together. And
yeah, when you get closer to your mic and whisper, it makes it quieter. Yeah. That's how that works.
Yeah, well, it does if you would just play along. Anyway, so yes, commend that movie to everybody. It's Soderbergh doing what he does best, in my opinion, with a little maybe more than the movie has to give. It shoots a little bit above its average speed, whatever that means.
It
that
shoots above its average speed. Yeah.
It's a thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, so enough of that stupidity. That's what I watched this week. I would really like to talk about something even weirder than shooting above your average speed.
Right.
Which is time traveling into the wrong year.
Yeah, I was going to say, Bruce Willis perhaps definitely shoots above his average speed, like over and over again.
Over and over. It's twice bald. Movie.
Yeah, so let's get into the time machine and talk about 12 Monkeys in the intro section, which we call Getting Jiggy with the Jiggy Watts.
1.21 gigawatts! 1.21 gigawatts!
How many times have we been here?
Would you believe me if I told you I was sent here from the future?
I want to know when and where you sent him.
What, you think I keep like a logbook?
Target vector, July 16, 1969.
So this is a 95 Terry Gilliam movie. Justin, where do you know Terry Gilliam from?
From Mary Poppins, I think. No, guys, from Monty Python, of course.
Yeah, he did a lot of, I'm going to say, all of their films. And among other things, though, as he was doing the Monty Python stuff, you know, Holy Grail, Life of Brian, Meaning of Life, all those theatrical releases, he was doing other stuff between that. He has Time Bandits, which is another time bendy movie. Weird like this one, but maybe not in the exact same way. His best, you know, quote unquote best movie is supposed to be Brazil. I haven't seen Brazil, Justin. Have you?
No, I haven't seen, I don't know that I've seen Fear and Loathing either, or The Fisher King, or
yeah.
I don't know I've seen much of his filmography outside of Monty Python.
So that's what it is. It's like he has absurdist Monty Python comedy stuff in his filmography and weird sci-fi fantasy stuff too. Like that's sort of his deal. So my relationship with him is like I've seen a lot of the Monty Python stuff. I've seen The Fisher King. I remember liking that. And after that, I think that's it. I haven't seen any of the other stuff. Annie, what about you?
I saw The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus when it came out, which was a long time ago. But it really is very much in the same vein as Monty Python. Like,
is it? Okay.
Well, you know, it has a little bit of Willy Wonka mixed in, but it's still kind of lighthearted, generally happy.
Whimsical
wonkiness. Yeah.
Christopher Plummer, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one where Heath Ledger, he passed away, and then they brought in a bunch of actors to play his part, almost anthology style, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is his movie, and I say that with a capital H and a capital M because I don't know about you two, but this has a really hard directorial stamp on it for me. Like,
sure.
Doesn't look like much of anything I've seen before. It stars some big names who were, Bruce Willis was a big deal. Brad Pitt was just becoming a big deal, right? When this came out, Madeline Stowe, steady career, but not, she would never reach Brad Pitt or Bruce Willis heights. Mm-hmm. Really. She was in, Last of the Mohicans too.
Isn't this kind of a David Morse's high point for his years?
Well, we
his
were
film.
I was looking and he's never like starred in his own like blockbuster big money, but he's like on every TV show ever.
I mean, this was like around the time of The Rock and The Green Mile, wasn't it?
Yes, you're right. If he has a peak, this is probably around it as far as silver screen goes. Because I remember him from The Green Mile. I don't remember him in The Rock, but I haven't seen The Rock since I was like 12.
Oh, he's there.
Yeah.
Well, and he was the lead in his own TV show, and he was on St. Elsewhere, so he was a
TV guy.
He was a big deal on television,
and he has strong TV villain energy, does he not?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
Yes.
Ponytail.
How is
all.
That different from a cinema movie villain energy, please?
I don't know. Like, he's got two scenes and a ponytail, and therefore he belongs on television. I don't know.
That's your thesis. That's, I like it.
That's the demarcation line. Yes. It's got a good cast. It has interesting kind of idiosyncratic director, and it is based on, quote unquote, based on a film. I believe it's a short film. How do we say this?
La Jetée, I believe.
La Jetée. Justin, you want to agree with the French mm-hmm. on that?
Sure. What is this? What is the spelling? This is going to get pretentious. Let's just go with what you said.
All right.
She's right.
It was close, if not right.
Yeah.
But I find it interesting that it's based on a short film that Gilliam said he hadn't ever seen.
Yeah.
So I don't know how...
I think that's from a screenwriting perspective. I think the screenwriters took that film and adapted it into a full-length right. movie, and he's never seen it. I buy that 100%, actually, yeah. now that you say it, because Terry Gilliam probably was like, do I care what the original mm-hmm. was like? Mm-hmm. No, I don't, you know? So, yeah, other than that, it is, Justin, in the intro section here, how does this relate to our other time travel movies? Because, again, we have... the initial offering of H.G. Wells' The Time Machine, which gives us our concept of what a time machine even is. We have Somewhere in Time, which is a similar kind of structure, but no yeah. machine, right? And then Groundhog Day, which is one of those time loop movies, and it's never really explained. Where would you put this one in the... if there were subgenres, or I don't know, you know, where would you classify this one amongst the rest?
It's kind of, you know, in the 90s, at least by my recollection, we had a lot of the Denzel Washington kind of thriller, mystery,
yeah.
suspense movies, right? And so this is kind of that because of the era it was in, but plus time travel.
Yeah.
So not that Bruce Willis becomes like a super action star, except in a couple kind of bizarre scenes.
Yeah. But, there are bizarre scenes in this movie?
There's one, actually. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. I said a few. There's just one, though.
You have to point that one out to me when we get there. Yeah.
Totally normal. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I was watching this. I'm like, gosh, is this a documentary? I just can't. Am I on the History Channel? So, you know, Travis, I guess the common thread, if there is one, with these movies that at least wasn't intentional on my part, I don't think it was on yours either, is that none of these movies that we've chosen, at least thus far, I think that's going to change big time at the end. None of them are really concerned with exploring how does time travel work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think for movies that, most movies at least, that want to explore time travel, that becomes kind of exhausting and uninteresting
totally.
Really mm-hmm. fast when they do. And the rare exception being like Back to the Future, where it's just like a kick in the pants anyway, and Huey Lewis mm-hmm. is there to, you're like, what, gigawatts? And then Huey Lewis is like, yeah! And it's like, all right, it's going to be fine.
Yeah, it's going to be
fine. So, you know, I think that is kind of, if this movie has a strong suit, I think it is that
yeah.
we just kind of accept, yeah, they can do time travel, don't worry about it. And, well, they can do it, maybe not very well, apparently, at times, but
yeah,
I don't know. Would you agree that that's kind of a thread that we've seen?
Yeah, I think I agree, like, I think less exposition in that regard, like less explaining to the audience what scientifically or technologically is going on is pretty much always the better route, because it's not real yet, or if it ever becomes real, right? Like, it's not real, and therefore you're...
Oh, it is real.
It okay. Well, you should have gone back in time and fixed me saying that then. No, I'm saying you're over-explaining something that is imaginary, and it's supposed to sound like real science. So I think, yeah, that's a dangerous trap. And I think Terry Gilliam goes so far in this movie to make it clear that, like, it just doesn't matter how it works, or
right.
or even that it works perfectly. And I actually think, like you said, that's actually sort of unique. And speaking of origins, we have a short film that Terry Gilliam's never seen. There's another source here, Annie, and I think you can help us out with this one.
Well, I can try, and I'm not going to succeed fully. So the name 12 Monkeys is referencing 12 monkeys who show up. This is deep and important, y'all.
Okay. Thank you so much for clearing
this
up.
No. So in the book, The Magic of Oz, which is the 13th book in the Wizard of Oz series, which, and this tells you something about me, dear listener,
yeah,
I actually just had in my garage. It's named after 12 monkeys who show up in this essentially children's book.
Yeah.
And I've spent the last, off and on, the last couple hours digging through this book to try to figure out a connection. And
it has something to do with them like being promised they're going to be fed forever or something weird like that.
Yeah. And I think the connection is tenuous. Yeah. Is I think that's the best I could say.
Okay, so I think we've set the stage here. We have the director, we have the cast, we have some of where it came from, and I think we need to get into whether any of it makes any stinking sense in the bulk of our review, which we call, in this case, Lessons in Lightspeed.
Well, I mean, wormholes, black holes, Tipler cylinders.
So not like fantasy, but science fiction.
Where are we going in your time machine?
Okay, now, we gotta set this thing to the 15th.
Fine. Do not lose that time device, or you will be stuck.
How will I know if it works?
You'll either know, or you won't.
I think I forgot to ask both of you if you've seen it before. I had not seen it before, Annie.
I had not seen it.
And Justin.
Yes.
You had?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I think I hadn't seen the very beginning.
Oh.
At least that didn't look super familiar, him being underground.
Interesting.
But the rest of it I had seen.
Okay. So I had not seen this. Annie hadn't seen it. Justin saw it one time. Was it like a long time ago or like yesterday?
Yeah, it was yesterday, man. Okay. I actually didn't watch the full movie for today. No, it was about maybe 10 years ago, 12 years ago, 15 years ago. Who knows?
It doesn't matter. You know what's super interesting on a podcast is if you just name years over.
Could have been 13, could have been 14.
Or 15.
Could have been 10 and 4 months.
So this movie is about Bruce Willis, who is a convict in a future prison. And
His name is not Bruce Willis in the movie.
No. I think it is important. Bruce Willis plays James Cole, who is played by Bruce Willis in this movie. And he's a convict in the future. And I don't know why this was. Okay, the opening crawl.
There's other actors in here, too, that are not playing themselves.
That's
true. They're
also giving
cast in
alternate
names.
Unique to this movie is they have given them names and roles to play. Yes. No, so there's an opening. It's not an opening crawl. That's what we call it in Star Wars. It's like a ticker from a computer or something. And it explains that what?
A ticker?
Yeah.
Hey, Sonny, I'm having a problem with my ticker on my computer. Could you come help? Yes, the ticker's just going boop, boop, boop instead of lip, lip, lip.
What do you call...
I need help.
What do you call the...
Tick, tick. It's a cursor.
Okay, it's a cursor. Thank you very much, Peanut Gallery. That explains
ticker.
That something has happened.
In the future, we will have tickers.
Okay.
And they will be here and there and everywhere.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead, Travis.
There's a virus, and it kills billions of people.
5 billion people.
5 billion.
Which equals 99% of the world's population.
At that time.
Big deal.
Yeah.
According to the movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So lots of people die. There's a virus. They're past that. Humans have moved underground, and he's in this prison, this subterranean prison. And we have to, I think, unless one of you disagrees, in which case we can fight about it, but I think we kind of have to take this thing to some degree plot point by plot point, because it's just insane. Like, this movie is capital B bonkers.
As long as we don't go too in-depth in that, maybe some broader brush strokes.
Oh, for sure. I just mean in order. We have to try to stay in order, I think,
yes,
for this movie,
yes,
because it bounces around itself, and if we bounce around, I'm going to get lost like I almost did watching the movie. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Annie did get watching the movie.
Yeah, I did have to rewind a few minutes a couple different times because I realized
that's the real time travel.
I did not know what was going on.
Yeah, I think this is a movie that is fair to say. At any point, you could be watching it and go, I don't know what's going on. And I think that's totally fine.
Well, success.
Yeah. So anyway, he starts out in prison. He's got a group of creepy doctors, and they tell him, like, hey, you want to reduce your sentence? we can send you on this mission. They're sort of cryptic about it.
Which is typically what doctors tell you. Right. I know from my last checkup, my doctor was like, "Hey, you want to take some years off of that commitment?" And I was like, "I'll do whatever you say."
Yes.
And that's how you end up getting things
shot in the leg by a World War One era weapon.
I thought you weren't jumping ahead.
I'm sorry. Forget I said that. No. Anyway, so Bruce Willis is sent in one at the very beginning to the surface to collect living samples of a spider, and he runs into a bear, and there's a bear and a lion.
Yeah, for you guys, did that, so like you said, Travis, it's supposed to be super, so diseased up top that he has to be in this cool bubble suit.
It
and
is
then
so
he
cool.
goes in
yes.
bubble suit and is going and sounding like Vader.
Yes.
And then he's supposed to take samples, but everything above ground seems to be living fine. There's bears and
yes.
there's a lion and there's spiders.
Yes.
And everything seems normal. So I didn't really understand the whole.
I think the idea is that the virus only affects humans.
Yeah.
And so the animals have taken over.
It says that. It says, like, the animals once again rule the earth or something.
I think
wasn't it a virus they cultivated from animals?
No, you're jumping ahead.
And yes, it was. So I think we could probably have a tracker for how many times this movie does something that doesn't end up panning out or making sense. And that might be the first one. Anyway, he's collecting living samples like a spider and a cockroach and stuff. And then they say, like, okay, you can do this other thing and we will give you a pardon, essentially. Like, that's hinted at, that he'll reduce his sentence almost completely. So you don't really know what that is when you're watching the movie. If you know stuff about the movie, I guess you'd infer time travel, and maybe because this is a time travel series, you might figure it out. But the movie doesn't give you any hints at that, really. And then what happens in the movie is a super violent cut from one time period to another time period. And there isn't like a, now we're in 1990 on the screen. It just goes, right? It goes from Bruce Willis sitting in a chair and they're like, okay, get ready, bub. And then poof, you're into the next scene. And I think that's sort of Terry Gilliam's very purposeful way of, like Justin said, under explaining the mechanics of the time travel and keeping you in a disoriented state as his character must be, right?
Right.
So let's just talk about, if we can, let's kind of go first act, second act, third act. That's probably the best way to do it because, yeah, Justin, you're right. Every scene doesn't need, an hour of explaining, but it does have kind of a clear 1-2-3 act structure where he is act one, he ends up in the wrong place at first. But the most important thing that happens is he ends up in the mental hospital with Brad Pitt's character. What did you think of Brad Pitt in this movie, both of you? He did get nominated for an Oscar and a Golden Globe. It's kind of a buzzy performance, and it fits right into the mold of how nuts the movie is. Annie, what about you? You're a Brad Pitt fan.
Well, yeah, so Travis has heard this theory more times than he probably wants to. But I have this theory about Brad Pitt, which is I love Brad Pitt movies. But it's never because of Brad Pitt. He just tends to be in movies that I like for reasons other than him, which isn't a criticism of him necessarily. This movie is different. Brad Pitt's my favorite thing about this movie. He's not the only good thing about it, but he's the most entertaining part of this movie. And I read a detail that they were worried that he wouldn't be able to be jumpy enough for the role, and so they took away his cigarettes because Brad Pitt has a very well documented nicotine habit, and so literally he's in withdrawals from nicotine, which is like fueling his performance. And
I buy that.
I liked it, although it was definitely loud.
It's a lot.
It's
purposefully a lot, but so is the movie. Justin, how did you take it, Brad Pitt's?
I mean, that's kind of what struck me when I was a younger man and I saw this movie. I thought, oh, maybe Brad Pitt's actually an actor, which I think he had probably given hints of before. I just wasn't, how many years did we decide to go? This was 13 years, 2 months, 3 weeks.
That was
anyway.
It was 14.
So, oh, 14.
Or was it 15?
In 3 and 5 days.
Okay, back to Brad Pitt.
Okay, so I really enjoy the performance. I really enjoy his the contact lens they put in like his left eye that makes it look off kilter.
Yeah.
Where that's fun.
It takes a minute, doesn't it? Like when the first couple times you see him, he's not, I mean, a lot of this movie is shot at like a Dutch angle up someone's nose, right? Like that's mm-hmm. one thing that it's got going on. But Justin, I noticed the contact lens like minutes after he had already been talking, because he's like kind of right. far away at first right. and he doesn't ever stop moving. And then there's one right. point where he turns around right to camera and you're like, oh, what's wrong with his eye? Like, yeah. So I thought,
don't you think he does a good job of, you know, for maybe a different actor, this just becomes a very kind of character bit.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
you know, and I don't feel like it, not that that's always a bad thing. But this could very easily just become like, you know, oh, this is what Brad's doing in this movie. It's just something nuts, you know. Mm-hmm. And this feels, it feels genuine. It mm-hmm. feels genuinely crazy, you know.
Yeah.
In the best positive way. He's nuts. So, yeah, I bought it.
It's heightened like everything else is heightened. It's not
sure.
It's not like he sticks out as like, oh, he's so off the wall in this movie. I mean, he is, but so's the mm-hmm. stinking movie, you know.
So, yeah. Travis, you said that they had considered Johnny Depp for that role.
Yeah.
And I think Johnny Depp may have done exactly what Justin was praising Brad Pitt for not doing.
Yeah.
You know, you look, go watch Johnny Depp's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory or yeah. whatever it's
just like
called.
Overly caricature-y.
Right. Kind of. Where you're not watching a character. You're like, oh, look how Johnny's being weird in this movie.
Yeah. It's all bits or
yeah.
something.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. I think he may not have done it as well as Brad Pitt did. So I was.
Yeah. I tend to like opposite of what typecasting is on people. Like I not everybody does all the time, but like Justin, we talked about Jimmy Stewart in Rope. A lot of people think he's miscast.
Yeah.
I think it works better because of that. In this case, like I prefer when Johnny Depp does normal people, and I kind of like seeing Brad Pitt do something like this, or even in Burn After Reading, Justin, when he's like the uber like dunce.
Yeah.
He's so
mm-hmm.
stupid.
Yeah.
Like, because normally he's the cool suave collected mm-hmm. guy, and in that movie he's so dumb.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that a lot. And it's a knockout year for him. I mean, he does Seven, which is this huge hit where he's not this character.
Mm-mm.
He's like the most grounded, like sympathetic character in the movie, aside from, you know, Morgan Freeman is the same way, but and then he does this in the same year. So I mean, he shows a ton of range.
Well, and he does Legends of the Fall, where he's the heartthrob, the year before.
Yep.
And then he does Interview with the Vampire, where he is, wait for it, vampire. also the year
Damn.
Before. So, I mean, you look at those like
yeah.
five movies in a row
it's a
in
lot.
2 years, and it's an incredible amount of range.
Yeah, it really is. And he doesn't really start playing himself over and over again until he hits like that superstardom, and then he gets a bunch of roles in a row, especially like by the time you get to Ocean's 11, it's like, okay,
yeah,
this is sort of Brad Pitt's
mm-hmm,
thing. And
mm-hmm.
it's fun, mm-hmm. right? But like Andy said, most of the time it's him having fun surrounded by people that are probably a little bit more impressive than him. So his performance is definitely to be noted. Let's talk about what happens in this plot if we can do it. So I have a couple questions about the mental hospital sequence. Number one, we see Bruce Willis learn a little bit more and more about where the virus came from. He's supposed to be finding out how it happened and possibly helping them prevent it. It's pretty vague. I want to know, how did he get the key? Can anybody answer that question?
To me, that didn't bother me, actually.
Mm.
I figured Jeffrey's just kind of an off-the-wall character, as you said. I don't know, that really didn't, maybe, hey, I could be the odd man out.
Well, I'm just saying, like, I could pick several things in this movie that I'm like, oh, I just give him that one, suspend my disbelief. But like
yeah.
you said about the animals and the virus, I feel like
yeah
these,
is that your animals,
well, the scorecard is just kind of stacking up, you know what I mean, at this
right.
point. So I did let that go in real time. I was like, I don't know where you got the key, I guess it doesn't matter. But as we go forward, my point, I think substantively about this movie is it's very fun. Like it's dark and it's kind of gritty, but also it's like frenetic and nuts, like especially with Brad Pitt's tonality and everything. But
yeah.
one thing that I think it suffers from is it's trying to do like layers upon layers upon layers with time travel and chronology and theme with all of those things. And it doesn't quite stack up to what it is. You know, it's not as smart as it thinks it is the way I would put
yeah.
it. But there are things in here that work really well. The second act is full of Madeline Stowe and Bruce Willis being more together. And this is where I'm going to put something out there for both of you to kick around. I found at this point in the movie that, like, I literally wrote down, is this a love story? Like, mm-hmm. And it took me a long time to get there because he doesn't really show his affection in a super overt way until they start to, I don't know, he's kidnapped her and she's stuck with him, but he starts to show that he's interested or whatever. Basically, I want to put on the table is I think this is a good example of neo-noir. Because his character really fits the mold. The movie is Terry Gilliam's thing, right? It's fast cuts, it's Dutch angles, it's crazy sci-fi equipment floating in the air with lots of eyeballs on it. But the character of Bruce Willis is basically our hard-boiled, out of his element, not really knowing how to solve the mystery, and he's falling for the dame kind of a thing. So what did you two, Justin, what did you think of like that dynamic? Can you talk about Bruce Willis, Madeline Stowe, or the way that all plays out just in general?
Yeah, I would say that's not probably the movie's strong suit, at least not for my money.
Yeah.
It's not that it's super clunky or that it's like, oh, you know, give me a break or whatever. But just that, you know, you do have this guy who is by all, it's very reasonable. I think to this movie's credit, what often doesn't happen is you have a story like this where someone is like out of the water or they, you know, time travel, I guess, and they get to, you know, some person and they need to convince them of something really urgent. And they sound totally believable. And it's like, yeah, that makes sense. We should probably listen to this person. But because of the plot, they're like, ah, no, this guy's crazy. Well, in this movie, I think they do a really good job of, you know, he does seem crazy. And I think it's really believable that he just seems like some nut dude. That has escaped. And, you know, when he is retelling his story, like, we all live underground and 5 billion people are wiped out. It's like, yeah, I've heard those people before. That does sound, you know, not rational. So I think they did a good job of framing his character so that it's like this dude has lived underground for a long time.
Right.
And he's been in prison. He's not exactly skilled in socialness. And who knows what happened after 1997, you know. So I just buy that he would be so, like, unable to connect and, like, you know, fake a normal person in 1996. So I think that was well done. I think her character was Madeline Stowe's character, Dr. Rayleigh, with two L's. That's really important. I thought that was done well up to a point, and I don't really fault Madeline Stowe's acting.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was totally fine. I don't know that there was any fireworks there necessarily, but I don't really, she's not given like, she doesn't have like a sweet soliloquy or something, you know. There's not a heck of a lot of meat, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And so, for me, though, the movie, maybe it's not quite like it lost me or it's on really shaky ground, but when we get to like her giving that speech about Cassandra from The Legend of Troy or whatever, I think she called it a complex or something. And then she's going through like all the historical evidence of essentially these time travelers from 2035.
Yeah.
And people are just like, yeah, that's ridiculous. And it's like, well, how the heck do we explain somebody that showed up in 1235 or whatever during the Black Plague and is like, hey guys, you're all gonna be wiped out. And they speak a different language. And then there were these two guys in World War One that showed up. And these, I mean, it's just that they, I thought it was a little silly, maybe a small misstep to put that kind of detail in the movie, because it's like that's not like History Channel, like, were aliens responsible for building the pyramids, you know? Like, no, that's just stupid. This is like, hey, this is totally unexplainable and should maybe cause us some real concern, and everyone's like, ha ha ha, the 5 billion people, that's hilarious. So I thought maybe that was a little goofy.
Yeah.
As far as their whole relationship, it's believable to me that they fall in love if you let it be. If you really, I think, kind of like you're talking about Travis with the key or with the animals all being hunky-dory in the beginning in 2535, if you really think about it, it doesn't make a lot of
it's,
sense.
In that sense, it's pretty noir, though, right? Like, you've got two people
totally.
Who, I mean, her character is more human and fleshed out, but the love story there is like, well, okay. I don't know. Like, what did you think, Annie?
Well,
I might want to rest on Bruce Willis because I think you have some thoughts.
I have thoughts about Bruce Willis. I don't know if I'm right, but I still have thoughts. Is that I just struggle with his casting, and which is not actually at him, because I think it, my problem might be how he was directed versus, you know, his own choices. But Terry Gilliam purposefully gave him a list of, of things not to do. Which
double
was,
digits things not to do.
Yeah, and it was all basically the action hero persona that, you know, had gotten him famous to that point. And Bruce Willis went with Gilliam's direction and didn't do any of the things that had made him famous. But when you take away all of the good things that a person can do that have given them success and say, don't do those things, what you're left with is a little dull. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't really blame Bruce Willis for that necessarily, but I just found him not very interesting to watch.
Yeah.
And I just wish someone with maybe a little bit more energy was in the role. And I even look at like the character Jose, who is his friend from the prison. You know, he was, you know, at least in the world of the movie, he had lived, you know, the same existence that the Bruce Willis character had. And yet he was more human.
More spark. Yeah.
There's more spark. And I get the noir connection of the, you know, person out of time and, you know, kind of a little hard boiled, but
it's okay. I think I agree. Like I found myself with the same, like I walked away with the same thoughts, but I was kind of entranced by the fact that that was what I was watching. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not saying I loved what the end performance was, but I was watching it like, man, he really is not doing anything, like, you know what I mean? Like the direction was so clearly to like mute so much because he's so charismatic and almost like jokestery and, you know, wise ass kind of a character, you know, that in this he's like so like he's in the fetal position for half the movie. There's constantly something oozing out of his mouth, whether it's
so gross,
like saliva or blood. And when he is talking, he, like Justin said, he appears to be an insane person. So I do think there's something interesting about it, like as a time capsule piece, because I don't think you ever see Bruce Willis do this little ever again that I can remember. But it does make for, like we talked about almost, Justin, with the Asphalt Jungle, with what's his face?
Yeah.
Lead guy in that is our leading man, and he's kind of like wooden, right? And I think there's something similar here. I think the one thing that this movie benefits from is that nobody around him, not a single person, is doing that same thing. Everybody else is a little bit like the opposite. My one B character poll that I would love to mention is Frank Gorshin as Dr. Fletcher. Yeah, this guy knows what kind of movie he's in. Like, he's chewing scenery like it is cotton candy, man. Like, the first time you see him, he's like, see, you're being defensive. You know what I mean? Like, every line reading is so overwrought. And then he does that thing where Bruce Willis has disappeared where he goes like, with his tongue for like, and then the last thing is when he puts a cigarette in his mouth in his office, he puts it in sideways and then turns it around with his... So, I don't know, like, in a movie where that exists, also Bruce Willis is like, he's not really emoting. Even when he's angry, it's like numb and yet it bobbles between like that and he's dancing around like in a river.
Well, I feel like he's just never human.
Yeah.
He's either completely muted and comatose or fetal or something.
Or raving.
Yeah. Or he's animalistic.
Yeah.
Like there's nothing, maybe at the very end there's some humanity there, but.
And I think that might have to do with, I watched this interview with Terry Gilliam and Charlie Rose from around when the movie came out, and Terry makes this comment in there when they're talking about Bruce Willis, and he says, I really didn't want a big actor at all to be in the main role because I was afraid they wouldn't be willing to essentially do what Willis was willing to do.
Yeah.
And so he talks about how he told Willis, look, dude, you got to come to this naked, essentially. As a performer, and take away and literally lots of his bottom cheeks.
I had I definitely had a tally for butt count going after a little while.
Yeah, it gets a lot of screen time.
Yep.
So good for that.
His butt got nominated for a Golden Globe, I think.
But just the right. But just, you know, despite the real nudity there, him talking about, you know, in a more artistic sense of the naked performance, I think I get what he's driving at, and it does make sense that that would leave the actor being rather animalistic, as you guys mentioned.
Right.
I just don't know that that was really what the movie needed to make it good, ultimately.
Sure.
It makes it interesting, like I think we've all agreed, but maybe Bruce Willis doesn't need to be, Die Hard 1 Bruce Willis, but, you know, surely there's some ground between that and this.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if this movie had James Cole just emote a little bit of charisma or generate a little bit of sympathy for the audience. From the audience, that it might have been a bit stronger.
So Jeff Daniels, I think, was the other name that I saw floated, and that I think that totally changes it. Even if he's doing a little bit more of a muted Jeff Daniels, because I think the problem with Bruce Willis, I think miscast is appropriate here because he did everything he was directed to do. Right, he did delete all of the bag of tricks of action hero guy. But I don't think people can really look at him and not see Bruce Willis. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? He's just not, he's not a character actor. He's not some method, puts on other people's skin like Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, or something like that. So I think you still see Bruce Willis in a sci-fi action thriller, whatever this is, movie. And it's just, it almost feels like it doesn't feel like a mistake, but it is definitely lacking, like you said, it's lacking stuff. So, okay, let's get into some theme stuff because I think there's a lot here to poke at. I'm not sure there's a lot here to really grab onto, and this is where I'll turn to you two. But what I see threaded throughout the whole thing, and it's not very subtle, right, is the destructive nature of the human race is like brought up over and over again. The idea of this virus killing off most of the population. And then you have the activists, right, the actual army of the 12 monkeys, who are, I guess, in the end, not so much gonna end the human race, but they're just gonna let the animals free. But the idea that humans are bad and they're ruining the planet and they're ruining each other, and you know, we're the virus all along, or whatever, however you want to put it, it's there in almost every scene in some way. There's references to the Book of Revelation. There's, you know, they talk about the Florida Keys 16 times. So I'm just wondering, like, what did any of that like shake out as worthwhile for either of you? For me, because of the way the story twists and turns at the end, and I think kind of clunks to the finish, if I'm honest, too many of those happenstance things that I couldn't excuse kind of pile up. Things like there's this woman that they find in the park and you think, oh, he throttled her. It's not actually her. She's in the trunk, but who's that woman? It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. That's gone, right? Like, that's just in the, especially in the third act here, when things start to wrap up, there's like red herring after red herring. And I think for that reason, those themes that might have been explored really well, they get kind of shoved off to the side. Did you have anything, Justin, that like jumped out to you as actually an effective piece of like messaging or theme in this?
I wish I did, because the movie's got a lot of potential and, like you said, offers up several hundred interesting kind of turns the plot could take and really maybe say something. And it seems like in, you know, with some different edit or a different draft of the script, maybe it did.
Yeah.
Or it definitely could have. I believe that David Peoples and Mrs. Peoples could have written this. I mean, this is the guy that wrote Unforgiven. So. Yeah. You know, I mean, they know how to write a story, but this is unfortunately, yeah, this is like, I don't know, like a bad action novel or something where it's just, you know, stupid things are happening and there's not really an explanation. Kind of like with the lady getting mutilated in the forest and then 5 seconds later, it's all fine. I didn't really like the Bob guy, or the guy that calls Bruce Willis Bob.
Yeah.
You know, he's like is in the future, but you never see him. And he's also in the past. And at some points he's like, yeah, they sent me back and I took my teeth out. And then at other times he's like, I don't know who you are. It's just not, it's, I think it's really striving to be like, this is high art. This is like literature on film.
Yeah.
And it's really not, because it doesn't, you can't just throw out, you can't be J.J. Abrams and just throw out random crap and be like, wasn't this interesting? Well, it's not very interesting if that's all we get is, like, you know, raise the curtain and then close it again. And I feel like that's what we get. We just get a lot of, like, behind number door number three, door number four, and we never actually get a step inside and figure out, you know, does any of this mean anything?
There's just a Hitchcock-like giant theater sequence, you know what I mean, where they show this big chunk of this scene from Vertigo. And then for some reason it becomes The Birds, even though The Birds isn't one of the movies on the marquee. And I get it. Like, she put on a blonde wig. Hitchcock had a thing for the blonde leading lady. But, like, what is that? You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. There's a lot of stuff like that, especially in the last half hour that I'm just like, it's almost like he was trying to get all of it in or something. And then what did you think of the third act altogether, Annie?
I'm going to back up a step and then I'll get to that.
Yeah.
What I see happening through this whole movie is this, this idea of the descent of civilization, the descent of humanity, and that, no matter how hard we try, we can't prevent the destruction from happening.
Yeah.
Like, and I see it not just with the general plot, although clearly that's there, but also just with, we have these, they're constantly cleaning him, and yet the world is filthy.
Right.
And so, you know, it's this obsession with cleanliness, but you're in the middle of a pigsty. So, like, why are we worrying about cleaning so much? We have...
Because his butt needs to be clean.
Because we just need to see it again. We see these holy spaces being used for unholy purposes.
Yeah.
We see these... museums and, you know, beautiful theaters and places that once had grandeur, you know,
and culture
and now they're just, you know, turned into mental hospitals and prisons,
places where people try to assault you and
they're dangerous and they're dirty. There's one scene that got my attention, and it's a beautiful marble statue. It's a famous one that I've forgotten the name of. But somebody's put a wine glass with a cigarette, you know, smushed out in it on the beautiful Renaissance
marble
statue.
That's kind of good, actually. Yeah,
and it's just this, like, this constant decay.
Yeah,
And we're helpless to stop the decay.
Right,
and you know, that got through.
Yeah,
you know,
real uplifting, super fun, joyous, buoyant message. Yes,
but I do agree with what you two have said, which is, I think there was something to say here, but then their big, like, action movie ending just, like, pulls the rug out of any sort of deep thought they were trying to communicate.
It's almost like an Agatha Christie level, like, oh, that dream he's been having the whole time, everything's going to fall into place, everything's going to connect. And, like, I appreciate if, almost like in a Christopher Nolan-esque way, right, Justin, where, like, something can be beautifully crafted in a way, like a story or a yarn, but, like, it can also be, like, paper thin and empty, you know what I mean? And I feel like a lot of the third act here, with, like, them turning into the figures he's seen in his dream and the little boy being there, but it's not current him or whatever. I thought it would be more interesting, just for the record, if it was just some other boy. Like, if it was, like, if the boy in the dream was just not him and he just thought it was, and it made, you know, the switcheroo was he was the guy getting shot. But yeah, I don't know, like what you're saying, Annie, I don't know how you take much away from this movie if in the end he just gets shot and the movie's over. Like, okay, cool. I guess we're toast. Like,
I think it had more to do, not necessarily with the plot, but the visuals of it, like the bright colors and I don't know. I feel like if they had the same ending, but in the same world they'd been in, like, suddenly they go to the airport and everything's shiny and beautiful.
It's like Technicolor,
And I'm like, wait, where are we?
Yeah.
You know, I got confused many times while watching this movie.
Yeah, so. I wrote down at one point, and Bruce Willis ate the spider. And, Justin, do you have third act comments on how the whole thing kind of comes together and wraps up?
Well, you know, I think the third act kind of continues the what Terry Gilliam has a ability to do, and what could be more interesting if the movie maybe decided a little bit more what it wanted to be, is that he does balance this really, he is a great comedic mind, obviously, and but he can tell a story that is more dramatic. So you have these weird juxtapositions of these things.
Yeah.
So, like, when Bruce Willis is dying, and it's kind of this maybe tender moment, well, it's sort of ruined by his wig and mustache. And so, but that feels, like, intentional. And because it feels intentional, it's twice as confusing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, why do we have this dramatic moment where this main character, the protagonist, is dying, but we also kind of want to laugh because he has this 70s handlebar thing going on.
Yeah.
Like, so that's not just there, right? You've talked about the eyeball computer that's kind of swirling around him, and the scientists, you know, all being kind of nuts. They're kind of fun things. But because it's just such a strange... I'm all for strange. I'm not saying it needs to be more normal.
Yeah.
But I don't know that the movie has really... our friend David Lynch. You watch a David Lynch movie, it's not normal.
No.
But it feels very sure of what it is.
Yeah.
Right? Even if you're not sure what it is, you know David knows, this is my movie.
Yes.
Right? And so I don't really get that same... I don't know if that's a studio thing. I don't know what it is exactly. But I don't feel like it's completely comfortable with what it is, and so it's trying to please different parts of itself.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it leaves me kind of shrugging my shoulders, going, I don't really know that I care at the end.
I think that's a good comparison. There's stuff in here that's as weird as Twin Peaks or whatever, but none of it, like, sinks into your psyche in the same way. None of it, like, stays... I'm not going to be, like, awake at night thinking about 12 Monkeys. You know what I mean?
Right.
Except for one moment, which is just when the doctors sing Blueberry Hill to him when he wakes up. That's freaking horrifying. But again, it doesn't mean anything, right? Like, they heard it, so they sang it to him, and they're kind of weird. And then you're moving on. There's no, like... there's no spirituality in this movie to me, right?
No.
And that's something that... If there's nothing of the divine in a story that is so clearly, like, you know, reckoning with these big questions, I don't know what to do with it either way. You know what I mean? It's not scary to me that someone could be this hopeless, because it never bothers to offer up anything other than, like, surface level, questions and answers. And at the same time, it doesn't, none of the really, like, quote unquote unsettling imagery. I'm not gonna have a nightmare about any. It's just too. Like Justin said, it lives in the world of, like, I don't know, like, almost like court jester level bananas. Like, even the guy on the street who's, like, the street preacher guy is, like, I don't know, the way they shoot him from, like, under his chin, and he's always, like, there's nothing about that has anything to do with reality. So, I don't, it's a hard one to, nothing really stuck for me in a meaningful way. Although, I will say, like, I kind of enjoyed watching it. Like, it was an interesting time. Any other tidbits? Yeah, Annie.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
So there's the lady scientist who's kind of very stereotypical with the, you know, bright red lips and, you know, she's the lady scientist. And she's, you know, scary and, you know, whatever. The very end.
Yeah.
It's a younger version of her, or at least that's what we're supposed to understand, sitting next to David Morse on the airplane. And
I didn't catch
and
that.
And he says, oh, like, she says, oh, where are you going? What are you doing? And they have this little conversation.
Yeah.
And then he says, like, oh, what do you do? And she goes, I'm in insurance.
That's the last line in the movie.
Yeah. And so, y'all, I could not figure this out. So she's in insurance. So is she actually insuring that the virus does get out? Or are we supposed to think that, like, she switched careers in the intervening 40 years?
She just became a doctor,
but, like,
post 40 or whatever.
That line, it's the last line of the film.
Yes.
It is said with great, like, gravitas and, like, spotlights on a line, if that's possible.
It's like, Luke, I am your father.
Exactly.
Or I am your father.
And it's,
no, I am your father.
I'm in insurance.
Yeah.
And so, and it's like, wait, were the scientists actually trying to get the virus out instead of trying to stop it? And I will say that is, like, the one thing that stuck with me after this movie is, what does that line mean?
I did not read that as a younger version of that other character. But regardless...
You did,
Justin?
Oh, for sure.
Okay.
I think it's the same actress, isn't it?
I think so.
Makeup.
I didn't even notice that. There's enough going on in this movie that I wasn't...
tracking
2035 to 1996 or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it makes a difference whether it's some strange woman or it's that same character. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Why. I don't understand. Let's not answer that. Let's ask another question. I don't understand why Madeline Stowe's character just up and realizes everything is fine.
It's because of the boy in the well.
No, no, no.
Oh.
She starts being convinced that Bruce Willis is not crazy.
Because of the boy in the well.
The boy in the well, the bullet in his legs in antique. Right. She sees him in the picture. But there comes a point where Bruce Willis has come back again, and mm-hmm. she's like, No, I believe you now. I believe mm-hmm. you now. We have to stop it. And then they walk down the street, and he mm-hmm. sort of says he loves her, and she's like, oh, maybe I love you too. Mm-hmm. And he sneaks into a... She goes to make a phone call, and she comes back, and she basically says, like, everything's going to be fine. We just need to leave because the police are after us. And my question is, why is everything fine? Do you know what I mean? She's like, when they go to the airport at the end, she's not like, we have to go and chase down the man to get the virus. They're like, we're going to go start a new life together and everything... I don't understand what changes for her to be like, you know what? Virus taken care of. I don't understand.
Is it
that.
Because she thinks rightly that they've stopped the army of the 12 monkeys?
That's what I took it
and
as.
And they don't realize
but
yet.
But they didn't stop the army of the 12 monkeys.
Yeah, they did. Or they got the information about them, but they just didn't realize that the army of the 12 monkeys, spoilers, y'all, that the army of the 12 monkeys isn't the people who put out the virus. So she thinks that they've stopped, sent the information into the future to make them stop the virus army, not realizing that the army is not associated with the virus.
Okay. I guess that makes sense. I didn't track that. It happened so fast. And I was not, like, looking at my phone. I was watching this thing.
I'm still trying to figure out the lady on the plane. So,
okay. I don't know the lady on the plane. Justin, do you have any answers to any of our queries?
I don't know that I have an answer for lady on the plane, but I can at least try. And so I agree, Annie, that line is said as if it's like, you know, oh my gosh, it all makes sense now, except it's more like, what? You know, mm-hmm. like if I was a cartoon character, I just have a question mark over my head at the end of this movie. And I did take that as your latter kind of theory, mm-hmm. that she, because like she's probably like one of five women left apparently, mm-hmm. and has an access to a good supply of really red lipstick. she just decides, yep, I'm going to be, I think her character, at least in 2035, is referred to as the astrophysicist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, I just take that as, you know, population is so destroyed and mm-hmm. so minimal that, hey, the world's your oyster. You can kind of do whatever you want. And so somehow she becomes an astrophysicist, which I don't really know what that – maybe that has to do with time travel.
It means if you put your mind to it, you can do anything. You can be anything you want to be.
That's the real message of this movie.
Is it? Well, then maybe it's speaking to just how much the experts aren't to be trusted. Like, the experts aren't actual experts. Nobody knows what they're doing.
You're giving it a lot.
I'm trying.
I think she was in insurance, and now she's an astrophysicist.
Well, and, you know, I think that kind of does echo what I was talking about a little earlier. If I can go back to that Charlie Rose, Terry Gilliam interview.
Yeah.
There's a moment in there where Charlie says... You know, Terry, this is a movie about a guy that goes back from 2035 to 1990 or 1996 and is trying to stop this. And Terry goes, whoa, 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 Charlie. And then he tells him, you know, actually, this is not really a movie. You don't really know that, Charlie. You don't know until the end that he's time traveling. And I thought, oh my gosh, Terry, if that's the movie you thought you were making, that's not the one that got made.
No.
Because isn't it freaking obvious from the very beginning?
Sure.
Like, he time travels back to 1990 and he's in the weird spacesuit they put him in, and then he disappears out of a cell. You know, so I didn't feel like there was any ambiguity in there at all.
No.
Am I alone in that?
No, I don't think you're alone, but I'm wondering if what Terry Gilliam is talking about. Okay, so I know we were all alive in the 90s. But I was quite
more
aware.
Alive.
More alive.
I was more alive. So, you know, 1995, I'm in high school. And so I just remember watching these scenes and being like, they are claiming, you know, and they're claiming to portray 96. It comes out in 95.
Yeah.
I'm still in high school. This is not a world I recognize.
No, it's not trying to be real.
It's not trying to be real. And even like the furniture and the technology and the like, none of it is accurate to 95, 96 or even 1990. And so I do think there is a like, wait, what? When are we? But he's still disappearing out of locked rooms. So,
yeah,
you know,
Yeah, I think that's a little nuts, Justin. If he thought there was ambiguity in this, I mean, they literally have verbal arguments about, mm-hmm. like, what year do you think it is? It's 1996. No, it's 1990. Yeah. Like, there's no question about it. So no. I don't know what that's all about. Anybody got anything else before we wrap this baby up?
Can I tell you my favorite line?
Yeah.
That's not meant to be anything special.
Please.
It's insurance.
When, it's, no, I'm an insurance. That's it.
It was when, I don't even remember the setup, but Bruce Willis angrily looks at someone and says, "All I see is dead people."
I wrote yes. that down.
Yeah. I laughed. When that
yeah.
happened.
Yeah. And you know.
You're really close to his.
I see dead people.
His, the Sixth Sense. The Sixth Sense. Not his line.
But still.
Yeah.
When Bruce Willis goes, "All I see is dead
you
people."
You know what? He traveled back in time after he had made The Sixth Sense and he said it.
Yeah. That's
and
it.
Before he was in insurance.
Okay, let's wrap it up in our section where we talk about whether this has any past, present, or future value.
Obviously, the time continuum has been disrupted, creating this new temporal event sequence resulting in this alternate reality.
English, Doc.
If you travel to the past, that past becomes your future, and your former present becomes the past, which can't now be changed by your new future.
Gentlemen, we're history.
Okay, why don't we start with Annie? Would you say this has any value for people? Is it worth your time? How often would you rewatch it?
I think it is worth watching if you like movies and you're interested in direction and theme and these actors. I think it's definitely worth watching kind of from an academic perspective.
Yeah.
I was not greatly entertained by it, and I'm not going to watch it again.
I just love that you picked this movie. I think it's so bananas.
Well, it's anyway, it went along with, I really like Brad Pitt movies. And so I was like, oh, Brad Pitt's in this one.
You're going to be a completist on his filmography.
I'm close. Yeah. I am close to being a Brad Pitt completist. So
you wouldn't rewatch it, but it might be worth your time.
But I think it's worth watching once. Okay. I like maybe that answer. Not more than that.
Justin, how about you, bud?
Yeah, I'm on the same page with Annie. I mean, to me, this is a movie that wants to be better than it is. It wants to kind of rise above being popcorn fare. Sometimes it succeeds, but if it has a major fault, I think it's that it doesn't revel in what it does best. It's like, I don't know, this is like an Olympic sprinter trying to do the marathon for the gold.
Yeah.
It is a good popcorn movie that is not dumb, and I think it would just be a better one if it knew that it was perfectly noble to be fun.
Yeah, so rewatchability is an interesting like metric on this one, Justin. Would you find yourself rewatching this or not so much?
Oh yeah, I'm with Annie 100%. Once is good. Like,
and you've done twice.
Kelsey, yeah, exactly. Yeah, shame on me. But my wife Kelsey asked me, you know, the next day, like, hey, do you have any more thoughts about that movie? And I was like, no, I haven't even thought about this movie. I totally forgot about it. So it's not really, you take a movie with Bruce Willis, remove the Bruce Willis from Bruce Willis, do an interesting time travel movie with a plot that doesn't answer most of the questions or just threads that it starts.
Right.
And you don't really, like, why bother coming back? There's interesting things here, but unfortunately, it's kind of the best I can say for it.
Okay, I'm going to put my answer to this in a sort of qualified statement based on some of the notes I didn't get to. So let me see if I can on the fly make this happen. So if you would like to watch a movie where a bum tells Bruce Willis that there's a tracking device in his tooth, if you think that a ponytail and a mustache are Brad Pitt's best look, plus the lazy eye, if you would love to see a sequence where someone asks someone, are you also divergent friend, and then they pan to his bunny slippers, this could be a movie for you. But I agree with the other two folks here. It's like, I think I probably enjoyed it more than the two of you, but mostly because of the car crash factor. Like, what the heck am I watching? I could see myself rewatching this maybe in a decade. In a decade, I feel like I will have reached the point where I'm like, you know what? The movie had some interesting stuff in it. Brad Pitt was really good in it. I think it was really weird. I might pop it in again, but it's going to take 10 years. Like, mm-hmm. that's how long it's going to take.
And maybe a little more distance from a pandemic.
Yeah, well, that doesn't help, but this movie's so... I was thinking, like, when it started with, like, mm-hmm. a viral outbreak, but I was like, oh, man, what did we do? Mm-hmm. Like, am I going to... And it was so off the wall that mm-hmm. I never even questioned it. I mm-hmm. never even thought of it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, yes, there's a virus and it has to be, but at the same time, I don't know. Like, I couldn't even think about reality when I was watching this. So maybe that's something to its credit. I do think that Terry Gilliam creates an environment and builds a world that is so unlike the real world that it is sort of entrancing to watch. But as a story, as a film from beginning to end, not everything hangs together. So there's some value in at least a one-time watch. I'll agree with you guys on that. But maybe not super duper rewatchable. All right. Well, no time machine that we saw in this movie. They just sort of sucked him into air. But Annie, thank you so much for finding all 12 of the monkeys with us.
Of course.
Yeah. I don't think we would have been able to find all of them without you. Justin?
No. I only knew if the three were.
I think we're still missing a couple. Next week, we have a very different movie. This is a Woody Allen flick. Yes. Yeah. Oh, was that your Owen Wilson?
That was.
Wow.
That was actually Owen Wilson. Yeah. Just came by.
Okay. It's Midnight in Paris. We'll have Ellie on, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Let the movie speak. Speak.
Hey, since you're still here and still listening, thank you, by the way. We'd like to ask an additional favor of you.
We have social media. It's a thing on the internet. And all you need to do is find us on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook and like and subscribe. I know this is annoying, but we have to ask you because we want more people to hear the show. In addition to that, if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, we would greatly appreciate it. See you next week. Bye.